you did today. And I will keep my remarks very broad for two reasons. One is I do not expect that everyone will have familiarity with any aspect of the tradition. And second is that I do want to share some of the bigger concerns and debates and trends that that we are experiencing in the field of the study of Islam that I suspect might resonate with some of you, and to perhaps receive some of your comparative reactions to what we're experiencing at the moment in the field of the study of Islamic law. And to do that, I want to begin with the comment that the term Islamic law in itself should be questioned. And many already have done so, have questioned the designation of the tradition that is referred to in its indigenous context as the Sharia, as Islamic law. And the Sharia, in the literal sense of the word, simply means a path, or if we're being very literal, it means a path to an oasis, very specifically. But it came to be known as the path to towards behavior that is compatible with divine commands or divine designs for the word world. And I am very careful not to use the term divine will, because as an Abrahamic tradition, very often we easily assume that when we easily assume a specific model of command and obedience that is somewhat intuitive, but not always true in the Islamic case. So the easy intuitive model of command and obedience that may or may not be largely assumed in the modern study of Islamic law because for reasons of Eurocentrism or centering Christianity over other religious traditions, assumes a willful commander, that is God, who wants particular behaviors and dislikes other behaviors, and therefore issues commands in a specific point in time for humans to act in one way or another. And these commands are binding for pietistic or dogmatic or other theological reasons. This model is familiar within the Islamic tradition, but there are alternatives. And in fact, the alternatives have been more popular in Islamic history. So the idea of a personal God who loves humanity, and that humanity is shaped or conceived in the image of God, has not been central in the classical Islamic tradition, but is not unknown either. So this is just an aside to explain why I do not necessarily talk about divine will, but I do talk about divine revelation as central to the classical Sharia. So the story begins with the Prophet Muhammad the sixth century of the Common Era, and going into the seventh century, received in late antique, early medieval Mecca, modern day Arabia, Muhammad was established in an environment in which other monotheistic traditions were well known. And his message was essentially a social one. In the beginning, his message was a message of social equality, critique of the disparity of wealth, of the disparity between the wealthy and the poor, and critique of the Meccan elite, of the pagan elites that lived in this part of the world at this point in time, and was a monotheistic one in the Abrahamic tradition. Those who are familiar with the tradition will find these things basic, but again, I'm not assuming any familiarity. Later in Muhammad's career, he migrated to Medina, and this is the point in time in which we believe the idea of a Muslim community became a reality, a separate Muslim community from the Mecca, from the tribal community in which Muhammad was born. And this community conceived of itself along the same form, political forms of a tribe, but it was no longer a tribe that is tied together by blood or by marriage and so on. It was a tribe that was tied together through belief, through the belief in Muhammad's message. And this is the point in time where we begin to see the beginnings of the idea of law in the Muslim tradition, the idea that we are a community now, we have to be able to settle our disputes based on a set of guidelines, principles, mechanisms that are specific to us, specific to our tradition. The same way the Christian and Jewish populations of Arabia have their own traditions, the neighboring Byzantine and Persian empires had their own legal systems. Now we have a new community that also has relationships with non-Muslim communities in the region that begins to think, well, we have to be able to resolve our disputes. We have to be able to answer people's questions for guidance in our own way. And therefore, the second half of the Quran was, which is the word of God, the revelation that was sent to Muhammad, and that was the the triggering event of the entirety of Islamic history. The beginning of this revelation took place in Mecca and was more moral had a message that was egalitarian and opposed to the order that was present in Mecca. And the later part is usually viewed as the more legalistic and political part of revelation. So why is it a problem? So here we begin to see there is a revelatory event that leads to the creation of the community. The community begins to create its own dynamics of dispute resolution, of establishment of orders order within it through organic appointment of wise people. That then these mechanisms over centuries became more formalized, and then that community began to see the specialization of jurists within it, and the jurists became over many, many centuries endowed with the power to make pronouncements as to what the Sharia is, exactly what is the law of Muslims on one issue or another, through many centuries, through a process of many cases of the issuance of legal opinions, and this creation of a specialized juristic class is what came to be known as the classical tradition of Sharia, and remained so for a very long period of time, for almost 1,000 years or so, until the rise of modern nation states in the contemporary Muslim world. Now, the question of whether or not this so-called classical and post-classical period is in fact a period of continuity is a highly questionable issue, and whether the move into modernity was in fact a violent rupture, a violent colonial rupture, as the post-colonial theorists claim it is again a highly contested issue. But this is the general, this is the general framework. We have Revelation, the birth of the community, the birth of the juristic class, the emergence of the jurist's law. The jurist's law was essentially there to guide the community, the assumption being that the jurists are self-appointed representatives of the community of Muslims. The assumption being that the members of the community, by virtue of subscribing to Islam or being otherwise affiliated with the Muslim community without necessarily being Muslim, they do want to abide by the Sharia. The Sharia, by definition, is a normative system that assumes that its adherents have an inner incentive to obey the law. It does not have to come up with other incentives. It does not. So the idea of coercion is not very central. Of course, there is the, depending on what you believe theologically, you might believe that you're going to be published and punished are the same thing, but you might believe that you're going to be punished for breaking the law in the next life, but that was not necessarily the case. This was not an essential feature of the law. The essential feature of the law is that we have revelation, and the revelation is a range of not necessarily very highly structured sentences and paragraphs and messages. They're not a code. They're not designed to be to generate a legal system. They're just things that the prophet heard and communicated to the community, and everybody memorized it. And so it's not even, you know, even the book that we know as the Quran is not revelation in itself. The order of the chapters, for example, has been shifted around. It's not the order in which the prophet received revelation. So this is not a mess. So revelation is at the core of Islamic law, but revelation was not designed to create a legal system in the way we understand it today. So it is one manifestation of, it is one manifestation of the desire of the historical Islamic community to live in a way that is that is aligned with their own beliefs, which is not very surprising. Every community wants to live in a way that it's, that is aligned with its own belief, with its own core values. Otherwise, what is the point of these core values? The other, but in a sense, calling it legal or calling it Islamic law is a development that came later. And the first references to Muhammadan law, for example, we find with British colonialism. In India, of course, the reference to Muhammadan laws, the references to Code Musulman in North Africa with French colonialism, these are things we do not see until the early to mid 19th century. But what is lost when, and before I talk about what is lost, I just have to mention that Sharia is also doesn't have an exclusive claim to normativity in the Islamic tradition, but there is also mysticism, tasawwuf, which is the other sort of major, I wouldn't say competing, but it's another tradition that has a major claim to the hearts and minds of Muslims over the centuries. And mysticism, unlike law, is not revelation-centric. It does not believe that the best way to resolve practical questions about practical reasoning is to go to the language of revelation that was revealed in Arabic to Prophet Muhammad at this particular point in time. But they do believe that the best way to attain proper behavior is to cultivate the soul through engagement, through nurturing the soul by engaging directly with the divine. Mysticism is not my area of research, so I will not say much about it, but there are many fascinating examples of scholars who were mystics and jurists at the same time and sort of wore these different hats. For example, the very illustrious Al-Ghazali, who died in the 12th century and is credited with many things, including introducing the Hellenistic philosophical tradition into the traditional Islamic legal sciences, and also rejecting much of the of that philosophical tradition at the same time. So very important figure, but he was also, towards the end of his life, he was a mystic, but also a fairly conservative jurist at the same time, who defended both both traditions, and I believe saw some ways of for both traditions to coexist, but also try to keep them separate at the same time. But the point here that I'm trying to make is that there's something that is lost when we say this is Islamic law. What is lost when we say this is Islamic law are two things. First is that this move comes with a tendency to assume that Islamic law will operate in a way similar to what we assume today about the law, that there is a legal authority that has the final say in what is legal and what is not, that there is some kind of institutionalized form of dispute resolution, and that even though there were institutional courts throughout Islamic history, courts never made law, even though some might say that in the Ottoman Empire, you know, in the latter part of Islamic history prior to European colonialism, there was an increased codification and increased role of the imperial power in lawmaking, as opposed to the image we have in the classical tradition of the sort of freely organized jurists. But still, the law didn't operate in the same way we are used to legal systems operate today. The law was deeply pluralistic. Deeply pluralistic in the sense that there were a wide range of views on any given question of law, and people had the freedom to choose between different schools. So each school would have a range of accepted opinion and opinions and a range of minority opinions. There ended up being four Sunni schools, and legal subjects were free to choose between the schools and between the opinions, as long as they operated within the framework of authority that was established by the jurists over the years. They were seen to operate within the realm of the Sharia. So one thing that is lost is that when we talk about Islamic law, there is a tendency to try to find phenomena that are similar to our contemporary legal phenomena. We're looking for sources and codes and courts and degrees of adjudication, and we're looking for a separation between law and a more clear separation between law and morality, a clearer separation between the secular and the religious. And we are disappointed when we find that these things are not very clearly separated in the classical Islamic context. And the other, maybe for my purposes, more important loss that we suffer when we do that is that people tend to zero in on the disciplines that can be said to be properly juristic or properly legal, and not be able to see how these disciplines, so the disciplines of substantive law, for example, and so the study of substantive law in the classical Islamic tradition would be a study of the body of rules created by the jurists in their schools of law. So the professionalized class of jurists produced these have a very vast heritage of cases and thinking through practical cases, and that would be the study of substantive law. And then legal theory, which is often seen as a methodology of extracting the rules from the sources. But then if we today we say we are scholars of Islamic law, meaning that we study substantive law and we study legal theory and adjacent disciplines like legal maxims, for example, a lot is lost in that process, because a lot of these disciplines are informed by debates in philosophical theology, for example. There is a lot of overlap between these disciplines and ethics. We are losing a lot by not seeing the intersections between these disciplines and linguistic disciplines, for example. And so a lot is lost by assuming that, you know, we can cut the theological introductions from these books and just go straight to what appears to us to be legal. But things appear to us to be legal a certain way because we are modern jurists trained in modern Western institutions. But it's not all problematic. So referring to this tradition as Islamic law, I think, also gets a few things right and is in fact helpful in a number of ways, because referring to this tradition as Islamic law allows us not to fall into, so the first move would be what would be referred to in the field as a post-colonial move, that, you know, the modern scholars of Islamic law, starting Western scholars starting the 19th century and much of the 20th century, brought too many assumptions from the modern legal education and disciplines into their study of Islamic law. And this is tied together with a particular violent colonial project that misunderstood the tradition because it wanted to subjugate the tradition and the people who are following it. But the second part, which is what some of us are starting to realize right now, is that we can in fact go too far in this post-colonial critique. We can go so far as to say everything about the Sharia is unlike anything we know about the law today, and that also isn't helpful because it's not true. There are things about the Sharia that should be seen as familiar to the modern jurists. For example, the concern for legitimacy, the attempt to answer the question, why is one school of law more valid than another? The attempt to answer a question, why should we follow the jurists at all? The attempt to answer the question, how do we find a balance between considerations of authority and considerations of practicality? If we want to stick to the letter of divine revelation, well, what if this literalist approach is impractical? What if it leads to solutions that are incoherent, that do not work from an economic or social or commercial standpoint? So these are all structural problems that we find that scholars of the Sharia were concerned with, that do and should resonate with the modern scholar of the modern legal scholar in general. But the other aspect, I think, of the Sharia that has been a lot has been spoken about it, and this is the part of this talk where sort of I bring to you puzzles that we're dealing with currently for your hoping that to have your suggestions and insights, which is the fact that a lot of the study of Islamic law today seems to be framed around the question of can this historical tradition, the Sharia, coexist with the modern state as we know it? Can it be incorporated within the modern state? So before the present moment, in many of the Muslim majority countries, the discussion was about, well, we want to implement the Sharia, by which people meant we want to take control of the modern state and infuse it with Islamic legal principles. And those who say, well, we don't want any of this because humanity has moved on and we don't want this medieval system And we want to be modern, and we want to, history moves in one direction, and we want to move in that direction with the rest of the world. Of course, you know, there has been the Arab Spring. I can't believe it's been already 10 years since the Arab Spring, but that shook things up, and people started to wonder, well, you know, this duality between let's take over the state and make it Islamic, or let's take over the state and make it European, isn't really working. Should we think more deeply about these things? Should we think more deeply about, well, is there something inherently opposed to the modern state about the Sharia tradition? And so we have works like Halab's Impossible State, which has been both highly praised and highly criticized at the same time, which not coincidentally was published in 2012 or 13, I believe, shortly after the Arab Spring, which claims that Sharia, because of its structural features, because it's communitarian and moralistic, it simply cannot coexist with the modern nation state, because the modern nation state is pragmatic and violent and is based on, it has been born in a historical context where there was an increased exploitation of resources of the earth and of native populations that were colonized, and native populations in Europe as well that were also colonized within Europe by this new project. But you also have others who say, well, we can't, the nation state isn't necessarily this specific creation. It's also malleable to different traditions. There is place within modern liberal democracy for an Islamic form of governance. There are places where we can have it both ways in a way. And then at the same time, you have those who are saying, well, modern nation states in Muslim majority worlds are in fact Islamic states. These are not. So you have sort of the Assadian trend, which says everything modern state is European. This project completely, and this is also what Halaq would say, that structurally ended the pre-modern Sharia and established something completely new in its place, and all attempts to find middle grounds are simply trying to pay lip service to the pre-modern tradition. These aren't coherent or interesting, or they cannot have any degree of success. And then you have those who are saying, well, in fact, the birth of the nation state was in a way indigenous in the Muslim world. In much of the Ottoman Empire, there were attempts to move towards this model, and the Sharia, in a way, indigenously evolved into these states that we have now. And the reason why it's not working, it's not because it's colonial and foreign, it is because it's Islamic. And there, and it is that survival of the Sharia in the form of the modern nation state that makes it, that makes the current legal systems and political systems in much of the Muslim majority world in crisis. And, you know, a move towards liberal secularism would be how we should resolve all of our problems. So this is, in a way, the discussion that's framing much of the contemporary study of Islamic law. And there seems to be very little room for much else. And what I would like to have room for is perhaps to take a break from these. As somebody who's lived the Arab Spring and, you know, marched through protests and was shot at and inhaled tear gas in abundance, a break would be nice. And for me, a break from these conversations would be doing work in which we do we study the classical Sharia tradition on its own terms in a way that respects it as part of the human heritage, the human legal heritage. It is an attempt to formulate a system of norms and values that is coherent, that tries to remain true to its higher principles, to its core worldviews, and did so with I would say significant degrees of success for much of its history. And in that sense, it participates in the greater sort of conversation about, well, what does it look like when humans try to organize themselves? And in that sense, there is a lot to learn, I feel, from the Sharia. There is a lot to learn about dealing with language, dealing with commands, trying to reconcile positivistic and naturalistic tendencies, which also manifest in Islamic history, trying to reconcile literalist and more practical tendencies, which also manifest, how to create a legal system. I mean, I think it's quite amazing that this is a tradition that extended from, you know, southern Spain all the way to Western China for so many centuries, and did not really depend on any centrally appointed authority for it to continue to be relevant and coherent, and effective in doing what it claimed it is doing for a very long period of time. And I would say that there should be room for us to learn from it without it being an all or nothing situation, without necessarily being someone who says we need to dismantle modernity and bring back a more communitarian, a more traditional form of existence, or being someone who says we need to eliminate these medieval practices and simply modernize because, you know, Europeans have done it, and this is the way forward. I don't have answers particularly, but I have a lot of questions, and I thought I would share with you some of the broader things that I think about, and I think many people in my position, especially perhaps scholars in my generation, scholars who have not lived too long in the Orientalist and post-Orientalist world, but have been shaped by the promise and failure of a better future that the early 2010s brought with it, and we find ourselves asking ourselves, why do we continue to study this tradition right now? It is clear that there isn't one clear answer. It isn't to dismantle the Orientalist project. Much has been written about this. It isn't to revive the tradition in its pre-modern form. It's clear that this is unlikely to happen, but we still continue to love these classical texts and study them and write about them. And I think because we, as I said earlier, because we want to learn about how worlds that are very different from ours created ways of thinking and ways of behaving that are internally consistent and historically successful. And we want to, if we can come up with one suggestion for the way in which we go about studying and organizing legal systems today, then perhaps that's good enough for the modern scholar of Islamic law. So that's all I have to say. Thank you very much.